Okay, we're beginning Bereshis again. We're on page one in the Feldheim Chumash. The Margolin edition of the Feldheim Chumash, page one. So we start again, we start the Torah again. And this idea of starting again is actually a fundamental idea within Judaism, the idea of the circle, because there are two ways in which progress is made. You can either have a straight line, so you move along the line and you never go back to the point that you started, but then there's a circular motion where one always goes back to the point one started. And what's the difference? The circular motion is a kind of parable of the idea of infinity, because once you move around in a circle, there's no stopping. You just go round and round and round and round. Well, it's not the getting nowhere, it's the concept that there's no end to this process. Now, if in fact we, instead of making it into a circle, we make it into a helix. You know what a helix is? Yeah. You know the shape of a helter-skelter?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone knows the shape of a helter-skelter. Yeah, well, that's a helix. A helix is a circle, well, the shape of a spring. What does a spring do? It spirals upwards. A helix is the mathematical term for a spiral.
Like a staircase where I live.
A round staircase. A spiral staircase. So there, if you look down on someone that's climbing a spiral staircase and you forget the fact they're rising, you just see them going around in circles. You look at their hand on the banister, it's just going round and round in a circle. But in fact, they're going to a higher level all the time. So that helix or spiral has got the concept of infinity, that it's going round and round and round and never stops. And at the same time, it's got the concept of rising as well. So that Marian's point about getting back to where you started and therefore making no progress at all is not true. Because in a spiral, you do make progress. Because you get higher and higher and higher. Now this is the process that is happening in the world at large. You see, we have the concept of a year. Now, in Hebrew, the word for year is shana. And that is connected with the word shana means to repeat. The word shnayim means two. Because two is a repeat of one. So the word shana, the root, which is a root in itself, it means to repeat. So the year is, in a certain sense, a circle, a cycle. We talk about the cycle of the seasons. And it's going round and round and round. Winter, spring, summer, autumn, winter, spring, summer, autumn. It seems to be a kind of circle motion, cyclic motion. But the Rebbe explains in one of his talks that it's not just a cyclic motion. It is a spiral motion. It is actually ascending higher and higher and higher as each year goes by.
What is?
And the Rebbe explains.
Spiral. Right.
A spiral motion.
Evolutionary spiral.
The Rebbe explains that the world is actually spiraling upwards, meaning that it's improving and getting better and better and better all the time. And the proof of that is very, very simple. We know that every mitzvah that a person does, it's like an everlasting achievement which can never be taken away. It's like when someone's building a house, they put a brick and then another brick. The putting of the brick, it builds the wall and it builds the house. And assuming the house is not demolished, that brick and that wall stands forever. So mitzvahs are not just deeds that have come and gone. They are bricks with which we are building, spiritual bricks obviously, with which we are building a better world. a more spiritual world, a more godly world. And we are getting closer and closer and closer to the aim that God designed for the world. So therefore this idea of coming back to Bereshis and starting again should not be seen as what some people think of it. Oh, it's a boring old thing. Oh, reading that one again. Mm. Which reminds me of the amusing story.
I occasionally say that to myself, but I try not to.
Well, that's good.
That's good.
It's good that you try not to.
Yes.
Because in fact, the way I've explained it is it's not just a circle. Mm. It's a spiral. And we're going higher and higher every single year. But this idea of a circle and repeating it again and again reminds me of an amusing story of an old Yiddish mama who used to read the Chumash. And she in her earlier years, she didn't really understand what she was reading. But as she got older, she learned, you know, the Hebrew gradually made sense to her. And she ended up understanding what she was reading when she read the Chumash. So she read the Chumash and she read the story of how Joseph was captured by his brothers, he was kidnapped by his brothers and sold into slavery down to Egypt. And she was so moved by this story, she started crying. So as one of her children saw her crying, and she said, "Mum," the old mother, "Mummy, why are you crying?" She said, "This is a terrible story. Joseph, his brothers, they took him, they sold him, they kidnapped him, they nearly killed him. It's a terrible story, I'm crying." So anyway, that was her explanation. Anyway, a year later, they went through the whole year and the Chumash started again, and we read Bereshis and Noach and Lech Lecha until we get to the story of Vayetze and Vayeshev rather, where the story of Joseph and his brothers is told again. So this old lady was reading the Chumash again a year later, and one of her children was with her, and she read the story and she didn't cry. So her son said to her, "Mom, last year you were crying about this. Why aren't you crying this year?" She said, "Look, he did the same thing last year, and he knew what happened to him, that they kidnapped him and sold him. And this year he did the same thing. He went to his brothers and did the same thing, even though he knew what they did to him last year. So if it's his own fault this time, I'm not going to cry for him."
Oh, that's a good
story. So that is a woman who read the Chumash cyclically, but not as a helix. Mm. She didn't read it. She read it the same as last year. But really, when we read the Chumash every year, just as when we live through our lives, and we go through the cycle of the year, we are ascending higher and higher and higher, and the whole world is ascending with us.
But it's true.
The world is improving.
It's true.
All the time. Now,
if you go through that experience one time, then you should get smart, so that then you have to learn by your mistakes, not repeat them.
That's what they say.
So,
it takes a long time to learn.
The idea is that the world is improving. But you must surely have a question on the tip of your tongues. Mm. But don't we see that there are terrible events taking place in the world all the time? Mm-hmm. How can we say that the world is improving? Surely there are some good things and there are some bad things. So it means it's like hovering. It's not going higher.
That's a good thing. I heard it this morning. Mm. The sunrise. Do you know of Eva Howard?
Yeah.
I bet you're not. She said the sunrise is a kiss from Hashem. Isn't it beautiful?
Isn't it beautiful? That is so beautiful, and it illustrates the idea of appreciation of the things that happen in our lives, which we take for granted.
Yes, she is.
And sunrise is one of the things that we take for granted, but we have to appreciate it. And the truth is that our Jewish prayers in the morning, we make a special blessing on the rising of the sun. Yeah, after Baruch Hu in the morning, we say the bracha Yotzar Uvarech Hashem, which means that God creates light, and we say a prayer thanking God for the shining of the sun, Hamei Loretz, etc. That God makes shine the sun on the earth. So, getting back to the point, so we have this question: how can we say that the world is improving when there's a lot of evil in the world as well? So the answer to that is the Torah view of good and the Torah view of evil. The Torah view of good is that good is a permanent achievement. Like we said before, that bricks built into a wall, they're not feathers that blow away in the wind. They are a sturdy, static object that will remain there until someone decidedly knocks it down, or there's an earthquake. But buildings stand, and sometimes buildings stand for hundreds, if not thousands of years, because a brick is an achievement. And that is what a mitzvah is. The mitzvah is immovable. It's inviolate. It cannot be taken away. Once you have done a mitzvah that has created a connection between the Jew and God, that is an unbreakable bond. Absolutely unbreakable. Whereas evil, explains the Torah, is not of a permanent nature. Evil is like a shadow. A shadow isn't a reality.
But that repeats itself, evil. Mm.
It may repeat itself, but shadows also repeat themselves. Is a shadow a reality? I put my hand here, and we see a shadow. Mm. Is that a reality? It looks dark, but it's not a reality. It's just an absence of light. And when we take the hand away, the light comes back, and that's the permanent situation. So the Torah's view of evil is that it is a passing shadow, and it's not got a reality. Therefore, we can discount the evil of the world and say that that has got no permanence. And the good is a building that's being built and built and built the whole time. So the net effect of that is that the world is improving all the time.
What's that famous saying by Maimonides about shadows? Not to waste your life chasing after shadows.
I don't remember that in the name of Maimonides, but it sounds pretty good to me.
Of things that you can never really grasp a hold of, or something. Or
well, in our prayers, we've just had Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and after Nisana Taikef, one of the main prayers in the Musaf, where we talk about life and death, and our judgment for the coming year, and who's going to live and who's going to die, etc. So after that, we say a short prayer where we talk about Adam. Man, his form, his foundation is dust, and in the end he's going to return to dust. And it says, one of the things it mentioned there is that he is Kutseil Iver. He's just like a passing shadow. A man appears on earth and does what he has to do. When I say man, I mean women as well, of course, man in the generic sense, and does what he has to do. So what is his life? It's Kutseil Iver. It's like a passing shadow, or a bird flying by, and it's here now and gone later. So what is our achievement in this world? The answer is, the only permanent thing that remains after our life is gone is the mitzvahs that we've done. And the Torah that we've learned, these are permanent, like bricks in a wall.
I mean, people remember you for the good that you did while you were here. Not for the bad, but for the good things that you did while you were here. Does that
absolutely
that
true. Yeah. As somebody once pointed out,
yeah.
a good way of focusing oneself on what are the important values in life is to ask oneself, when people pass on from this world, what are they remembered for? Are they remembered for the fact that they lived in a big house and drove a Rolls Royce and belonged to the best golf clubs? Is that what the minister will eulogize them? Oh, he lived in this beautiful house and he drove this beautiful Volvo or Rolls Royce or Mercedes, you know, what a wonderful man, and the golf club he belonged to, wow, I wish we all could belong to that golf. You never hear a eulogy like that. You hear a eulogy that if he was a wealthy man, this man supported poor people, and he gave to Jewish care, and he gave to yeshivot. The good that we do, that's what people remember. They don't remember all the material pursuits that we pursue during our lifetimes. So if you want a focus to know what are the permanent things in our life, and focus on what people get eulogized for. And those are the values that we should maintain and focus upon in our lives. So all of this idea is generated by the fact that we're starting the Torah afresh, and this time we have to remember we're on a higher level than when we learned it last year. Because we have everything that we learned last year, plus we're learning something new now. Bereishis Bara Elohim. Eis HaShemayim ve'Eis HaRetz. That is normally translated as, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. But Rashi is very definite about the fact that it cannot mean that. It cannot mean in the beginning God created heaven and earth. And the reason why it cannot mean that is because the word Bereishis is what's called in the construct form, which means, literally translated, it means in the beginning of. It doesn't say Barishoina, which means at the beginning. It says Bereishis in the beginning of.
Yeah.
Of what?
It's always a problem. Always. We say it's the beginning, but it isn't the beginning. So what was before?
Ah, very good question. You always ask the good questions.
You know, scientists always talk about millions of years before. We don't speak it.
Well, the Gemara in Chagiga, one of the Talmudic tractates, tells us, it says, do not ask what came before and what is above and what is below. And that is hinted to by the letter Beis. The letter Beis, and notice the Torah starts with a Beis. You'd have thought that the Torah would start with an Aleph, being the first letter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in fact, it starts with a Beis. This is mentioned in the Zohar, and the Zohar says the reason is because the word Beis begins with Baruch. Begins the word Baruch, which means blessed. And the letter Aleph begins the word Orah, which means cursed. And in any case, the Aleph, even though it has good meanings as well, has been reserved for the Ten Commandments. Because the Ten Commandments begins with an Aleph.
But if you say in the beginning, it wasn't the beginning, so what was before?
That's what I'm answering you. The Gemara in Chagiga says, don't ask what was before, what is above and what is below. And it's hinted by the letter Beis. I'm going to make a letter Beis with my fingers to you. Right, can you see the letter Beis?
Yeah.
You see the letter Beis? Yeah. So the letter Beis is saying it's only open on one side. That way. The way you read forwards. So that's what the Gemara is saying. The Talmud is saying, don't look behind. Don't ask what's behind. That's blocked off. Because that's the letter Beis. Don't look above. Don't start investigating what's above the world. Don't investigate what's below the world. You just look forward into what? Into the Torah. You just keep reading ahead.
Focus
on what's coming in the Torah. You direct your investigations into the Torah. The Torah has all the answers. And when we start asking what was before, what's above, what's below, we can get into trouble. That's what the Talmud is telling us. The answers are in the Torah itself. Once we start speculating about the befores and the aboves and the belows, that's where we get into spiritual trouble, because we can end up concluding conclusions which are false, like the scientists have indeed done, where they start talking about the universe has always existed, or the Big Bang, or whatever. We have to know Bereishis Bara Elokim, in the beginning of God's creation. It's all come from God, and it's His creation, and we'll get the answers if we concentrate on the Torah. So, does that help to answer your question?
Yes, it answers the question.
If you want to ask, you know, how do we reconcile the Torah's view about the creation having been made 5,770 years ago, and the seeming age of the world, which seems to have evidence, or display evidence of a much more ancient existence, and some even estimates of millions of years, or even billions of years, the answer to that is something I've said over many times in this year. In God created the Garden of Eden. Now, in the Garden of Eden, were there trees?
Yes.
It says that explicitly there were trees.
There was a tree.
There was the tree of life,
yes.
And the tree of knowledge at the very least. Yes. And other trees as well, right? It says, Mikol Eitz Hagan, from all the trees of the garden. So we see there were trees. Now, on the day that God created the Garden of Eden, just after the creation of the world, if you would have gone into the Garden of Eden and cut down a tree, would you have seen any rings?
Any?
Rings.
Rings.
You know the rings on the tree?
The age of the tree.
When you cut a tree,
I don't know.
There are rings. And that tells you how old the tree is.
The tree is.
Now, if you would have cut down a tree in the Garden of Eden, would there be any rings?
I don't know.
Why should there not be?
Well, because then it would show the world would be thousands, maybe thousands of years old. If
right,
there was
that's the very point I'm making.
Yeah.
The God created normal things. He created a normal man and a normal woman, normal children, the animals that he made. Does it say that they were some way special, different? No. There was a normal lion and a normal tiger and a normal elephant and normal trees and normal grass. It was what we know.
Mm.
Right? So the trees must have had rings. God created them normal.
Mm.
If someone would have cut down a tree a few years later and there were no rings, they would say, hang on, trees can have rings. Why has this tree not got any rings? What's going on over here? It's not normal. God created a normal world.
Mm-hmm.
So he created a tree. In the garden, obviously, there were trees of different ages. He made saplings and older, just like a normal forest has got big trees and smaller trees and younger trees and older trees, because there's a whole cycle going on. So you cut the tree down and you see how many rings, you know how old it is. The same thing in the Garden of Eden. If you would cut a tree down.
What about the animals?
Yeah.
The animals were created adults, not babies. Adam was created like a man of 20. He wasn't created as a boy. He was created as a man. So looking at him, you would say to him, how old are you? So there are two answers to that. He would say, I'm one day old, because God made me today. Or his age on his body was 20. He looked like a man of 20. So the rings on the tree would indicate that the tree was, say, 20 years old, 50 years old, 100 years old, but they were just created that day. In other words, God created a finished world which looked mature. It looked old. So every different thing in the world looked a different age. And if you do scientific tests on the rocks, instead of showing that they were only 100 years old, it would show them to be 1 million years old. But they were all also created on that day. It was all done as part of God's plan to make the world not look like a new place. It had to look like a normal world. So therefore, that answers the question of how it is that the world looks like it's very, very old. The answer is it was created to look very old. Simple as that. It's a little bit like, you know, when you set a clock going and you put it on your mantelpiece and you do that at 3 in the afternoon. You buy a new clock and you come home and it's 3 p.m. and you put it on your mantelpiece, you set the clock at 3 p.m. Does that mean to say the clock's been going for 3 hours since noon? Or for 15 hours since midnight? No, you set it at 3 because that is the time you wanted it to be. It says nothing about how much time has elapsed since the clock was put on the mantelpiece.
That makes sense.
And the same thing with the rest of it. Now God, in his wisdom, decided that rocks should look older than trees, and that trees should look older than men, and so on. But everything was created in a finished state. So that hopefully helps to answer your question over here. So Rashi, as I said, is very firm about the idea that the world, that it does not mean to say in the beginning God created heaven and earth, because the word Bereshis means in the beginning of. So Rashi basically translates it the way it's been translated in this Chumash, and as he says, in the beginning of God's creating the heavens and earth, when the earth was desolate and void. So it's not telling us the chronology of what was created first. And when it says heaven and earth, we know that heaven, as Rashi points out, is made up of fire and water. There's fire and water in heaven. Where do we see the fire?
Well, it's in the sun.
The sun.
The heaven's made up of the universe.
And where do we see the water? There's water all over. Not only the rain and the snow, but the comets.
But that's the universe.
Comets are made up of ice and rocks.
Universe.
Yeah, there's water in the universe. So there is water and fire in heaven. And that's what Rashi explains. The word Shamayim is made of the two words Eish Mayim, fire and water. Or Shom Mayim, there is water there. So Rashi says, how can you tell me that the first thing that was created was heaven and earth, but heaven itself is made up of fire and water? That means fire and water must have been there before the heaven. Because if heaven is made of fire and water, the fire and water must be there first. So it can't be telling us, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. Because he should have said, in the beginning God created fire and water.
Because that was there before.
So therefore, says Rashi, it cannot be telling us the order, and we must translate it of as in the beginning of the creation of heaven and earth, this was the situation. Just by the way, there is a little vort, as they say, a little idea, nothing to do with what we're just talking about the word Bereishis. When we ask for blessings, we ask for three things: Boni, Chayim, Azoni. That means children and nachas from children. Chai means life and good health. And mazaini means mozain, food and a livelihood. So I can't remember who said this, but he said it's all hinted in the word Bereishis. So Bereishis is, in the word Bereishis bara. Bereishis bara. Bereishis means in the beginning. Bara. Now the word bar in Aramaic means a son, as in Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So Bereishis bara. The first thing we should ask for is bara, children. And then the next thing, it's not in order by the way, all these three things are what we need. Then the word bara means health, as in Briut. Bari in Hebrew means healthy. So Bereishis bara, ask for health first. So children, health, and then the final thing was a livelihood, to make a living. Now the word bar in Hebrew also means corn. Wheat, corn.
Well, corn is tiras.
That kind of corn is tiras, yes. But bar means produce from the field. So Bereishis bara is Bereishis bar. In the first thing we ask for is a livelihood. So these are the three things that we ask for, all hinted in the words Bereishis bara. In Hasidic teachings, it explains that the word Bereishis is made up of two words, bara shis. He created six. And in your lessons in Tanya, you will surely have come across the idea that there are seven divine attributes. And these are Chesed, Gevura, Tiferes, Netzach, Hod, Yesod. I won't translate them now because it'll take too long to explain them. And finally, Malchus. Now, the first six of those divine attributes are called, are classified as a unit themselves. And the number seven is classified as a unit to itself. And so the six are, and they correspond to the 6 days of creation. So bara shis, the word shis in Aramaic means six. Bara shis, he created the six attributes and also the 6 days of creation. And these six attributes correspond to the 6 days of creation. So chesed, kindness, corresponds to Sunday. And gevura, severity, corresponds to Monday. And tiferes, beauty, corresponds to Tuesday, and so on. So bara shis, he created the six attributes as well as the 6 days of creation.
Very quickly, just in English,
what these attributes mean?
No, what they are.
Chesed means kindness.
We'll just go through in English. Kindness.
Gevura means severity or restriction. Yeah. Tiferes means beauty. Netzach means victory or everlastingness. Hide means, is another word for splendor or beauty. It has a different meaning. Yesod means foundation and refers to the idea of generation, of generating the next generation. And the final one, number seven, is Malchut, which means royalty, which is also called Nukva and is associated with motherhood. And the first six are associated with fatherhood. That's why I said that the number six, you saw it, is the idea of generation. Because the father is the generator. And the mother is the recipient of the seed and grows the new seed for the next generation. So Zohar and Malchus, as they're called, are also associated with Zohar and Nekeva, which means male and female, mother and father and mother. So those are the basic six divine attributes. Now, we'll end off by telling over a Rashi, the very first Rashi in the Chumash, where Rashi answers the problem of Israel's claim to the land of Israel, the Jewish people's claim to the land of Israel, where Rashi says as follows. Why did the Torah start with this story? Why did the Torah have to start by telling us the story of creation and Adam and Eve and the flood and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc.? Why do we need to know these things? It's all very nice stories. They're really interesting, riveting. But why do we need to know them? Especially, says Rashi, when the Torah we know is a book which is a book of instructions. The word Torah means to instruct or enlighten. So it's a book that's giving us instructions as to how to behave in life. And that started only when the Torah was given. The Torah is instructions. Do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. So why does the Torah start with stories? And especially the story of creation. This is Rashi's question. So Rashi gives the following answer, which, as I say, is the answer to the nations as to what is our claim to the land of Israel. Because, says Rashi, the nations can easily claim that we are robbers. Because who gave us permission to enter the land of Israel and take it for our own? Right? Moses led the Jewish people through the desert 40 years. At the end of the 40 years, Joshua takes over. And he leads the Jewish people into the land of Canaan, as it was known. And he conquers it. And the Jews take over the land. So the nations turn around. Can you imagine the United Nations, if it existed in those days, having an emergency security council meeting? How dare this Joshua? Who is this Joshua? He's led these marauding Jews into Canaan. We're going to get the Saudis against them. We're going to get the Syrians against them. None of them existed at the time. And there was no oil lobby. So how dare you take over other people's lands? This is the question that Rashi asks. So he says, this story of Bereshit, of where God tells us of how he created the whole world, and he apportioned various lands to the various nations, is the answer. Because God is the owner of the whole shooting match. So he can decide who owns what. If I own a house, and I invite guests in the rooms in the house, I tell them where to go. You go to that room, you go to that room. And if I feel the guests are not behaving themselves properly, I can tell them to leave. It's my house. So God says the same thing. He says to the nations, I'm giving you some basic laws to behave by. The seven Noahide laws. If you obey them, well and good. You can continue living the way you are. But if you don't obey them, then your guests in my house, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And that's what God did. It tells us, the rabbis tell us, that God did not eject the nations that lived in Canaan, in Canaan, until they had earned their expulsion by their very corrupt behavior. They were idol worshippers, they were immoral people, they were murderous, they were violent, stealing, etc. They were totally immoral. And God said to them, you know, you've overdone it. You've overstayed your welcome here. I'm going to get rid of you. Pardon?
I'm holding it back.
So there you have the answer, says Rashi, to the nations. If they come to us and say, you're robbers, you stole the land, we say, it's not our land. It's not your land. It's God's land. And we're just visitors. God, you were visitors before. You didn't behave. So God, let us come instead. And the truth is that the same rule applies to us. Because God says to us, if you don't behave in the land of Israel, the land will spit you out as well. And so it did. So we see that the Jewish ownership of the land of Israel is also conditional on our behavior. So that is our basic answer. That God's the boss, and he decides to whom he's going to give the land, and the land, therefore, by the grace of God, belongs to us.